Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 20th of November. The New York Times is presenting its complete front pages. It's more than 300 front pages in a very, very large book, and all 54,266 front pages ever published on a companion DVD-ROM. We're going to be talking with James Barron this hour of our program about all of the news that you find from 1851 to 2008. And he is a reporter on the Metropolitan staff of the New York Times, wrote the minute-by-minute stories on the 9/11 attacks for the New York Times on the web and the front-page lead story on the 2003 blackout. He initiated the Public Lives column and currently writes a podcast for the Times website summarizing the next morning's front page. He's a contributor to the New York Times, The Complete Front Pages, and wrote the timeline summaries for this historic book, one of those books you want to hold on to as you look through what happened so many years ago and what happened last year. It's quite a piece of work. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, James. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning.
Yeah, nice to have you here. I was interested in the intro to the book that there are few more satisfying phrases in your business than you are fronted. You're on the front page of the New York Times. But it's interesting, when did we start getting bylines so that people knew who wrote the stories on the front page of the New York Times?
That came in after World War II, really, I guess, or maybe during World War II.
Hmm.
For years and years, the stories that appeared on the front page had no bylines. It was as if the paper spoke with one voice. Of course, if you read very closely, you could tell the differences between writers, different articles by different writers. And in fact, in the early days, some of the articles were signed with pseudonyms. At one point in the 1850s, the music critic went by the name Monadnock. But then after World War II, bylines became more prevalent, first the war correspondents, and then eventually everybody who was on the staff here got a byline in the paper.
Hmm. You know, it's so interesting to go through it because there's a different way you take in the history than if you're reading a history book. And I'm trying to, as I was looking at it last night, I was thinking, what is it that's different about this for me? It was more engaging in a way.
I think this is a wonderful thing to learn from. It's also a fabulous time killer. If you love to sort of delve into things, you can just start off on this and then see what else is going on and go to the next one. If you've got the DVD-ROMs in, you can go to the next day or you can go to the continued part of the article in a way that you couldn't when it was just a book of front pages. The Times has done front page books before, not on this scale, not with the essays that are in this book, and certainly not with the DVDs. That's never been done before. But you could look through and see what was happening close to, say, to your birthday. Now you can pop in the DVD and look at the front page from your actual birthday.
And you also get this when you're looking at the huge events of that time period, the Civil War, World War I, World War II, the Great Depression. As somebody said, you get an idea of the dailiness of all of this, right? Day after day, here's what happened. It gives you a sense of the enormity and the number of years that went by.
That's certainly true, although if you only think of it in that way, you run the risk of only seeing little increments. I mean, a lot of what news is on a daily basis is small little things. You know, we know in World War II there was a war going on, or there was the campaign leading out of D-Day once it began, and so the actual news events of the day weren't that much really in the overall context of what we remember, and yet at the time it seemed like so much.
Mm-hmm. Today is the 20th of November. The New York Times had a report of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address.
And one of the fascinating things to me about that when I was doing the summaries that are in the book, if you compare the text that we printed, which is over there in the third or fourth column, as I recall, if you look at the text we printed, there are two or three places where the text is different from the texts historians have been using. I don't know whether our reporter couldn't hear, because after all, there were no public address systems back then.
Right.
Or if you think about all of the other ways that communications and newspapers differed between then and now, maybe the reporter just didn't hear it. Well, I'll never admit that can't happen now, that the reporter gets it. No. But if you think about it, then how was the reporter filing? Presumably somewhere there was a telegraph line. Maybe the telegrapher didn't get it exactly right, sending it off to New York, or maybe it got garbled coming down at the other end. The two or three places didn't make much difference in the sense of the speech. You wouldn't have thought Lincoln got his math wrong and said 80 years ago or something. it was two or three small little things, but we do pride ourselves on getting the words right. And so it was fascinating to me that that if you compare this with whatever more or less accepted version I found, we're off on a couple of places, and I don't have a good explanation for why that is.
And I'm wondering, when you look through all of these years, does it take a while? Or it has. You know, I'm thinking about the speeches that President-elect Obama has given, and some people have said this is a historic speech, and they recognized it right away. Obviously, Lincoln's was a historic speech. But was there something about those times that it took us a while to realize that this was a masterpiece or not? What was going on? Why do we recognize some? And what about Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech? Those who heard it, did they know, woo, this is a big speech?
I think one of the things about any newspaper really is the collective sense that a group of good editors sitting around in a meeting can bring to what James Reston called the first rough draft of history. That's what he said a newspaper really was. And what I mean about a group of editors sitting around is, well, they plan the front page, at least here, by having the top editors from all of the different desks, the Metro desk, the Foreign desk, the National desk, and so on, in a room with the executive editor and the managing editor and some of the assistant managing editors. They get together every day they get together here now twice a day, once in the morning, and then at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And that 4 o'clock meeting is a long-standing tradition in which they decide what goes on the front page. The editors from the different desks have been in touch with the reporters, and they make the pitch. And if they understand, and they do, the significance of something, they make that pitch. And so you have in that meeting really a sense of what's been going on that day and what's important and why something should be fronted and why it should be fronted big in the case of the I Have a Dream speech. I think by the time that came along, the civil rights movement was well on the way. If I'm remembering it right, the Kennedy and Johnson administrations had embraced the agenda. There was some question whether they could get it through, get the civil rights bills through Congress. There was the sense that this was a moment that mattered. When you have a crowd that big in that place, that really matters.
Tell me about those meetings. Do they get pretty animated? Are people really talking loudly and forcefully about why a certain story should be on the front page?
Some days, but it's very collegial. Nobody huffs out or nobody stalks out angry. It's not like that. It's very collegial. You plead your case, and then it's usually fairly clear what ought to be there. And I think we all know that, no matter what the various editors' interests are.
Mm-hmm. There are times when you've used just not even a sentence, but it lets you know about the enormity of an event, the assassination of Lincoln on April 15th, 1865. It starts, awful event. It surely must have been an awful event. The second banner on September 11, 2001, U.S. attacked.
Yes, yes. Sometimes... Well, in the case of awful event, I think also that's the way they wrote headlines in the 19th century, that one still was really only one column wide. I mean, if you leaf through the book, another thing that you get is a visual sense of how newspapers have changed over time. If you look at the very first one, or as I recall, the one from when Lincoln was assassinated, the pages are very, very gray. There's very little in the way of illustration in those early ones. They didn't have photographs, really, until after the Civil War in any numbers, and really not even then until into the 20th century. So it was very gray. There wasn't a lot of white space, and the headlines, by today's standards, were teeny.
Right.
I mean, that's partly why you need a magnifying glass, and the book comes with one, to be able to read what was pretty much the normal size type from those days.
Oh, I didn't even see the magnifying glass. Here it is.
There it is.
Hey, I didn't know what that was.
And on the
it's
computer,
a magnifying glass.
And on the computer, of course, I guess you can zoom in,
right.
Make the computer do the work, but for the book itself, well, there is a magnifying glass.
Huh. Well, how did people read it back in the 1850s? I was thinking that as I was looking at this, and I wear glasses and have to, but I had a hard time with it as well.
I've been wearing glasses since I was 8 years old, so I'm in that category. I assume they folded the papers and just put them close enough to be able to read.
Huh. Interesting. We're ready to welcome phone calls. Here's our number, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the New York Times, the complete front pages, 1851 to 2008. It has just been published, and it's a combination of the print front pages and also DVD-ROMs that will direct you to the fuller stories for many of those front pages as well. And we also invite you to send us an email if you'd like, and that's talk@wpr.org. But join us by phone, 800-486-8655. Eugene from Viola is our first caller. Hi, Eugene.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen. I'll change the question a little bit. I was going to ask about Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce and how they dealt with his surrender in 1877. But an overall question is how the New York Times dealt with the Indian Wars of the 1870s and 80s.
My sense is that was hard to cover because the news trickled in. It trickled in very slowly. In the case of Custer's Last Stand, for example, that story was on the front page, I think it was 2 weeks after it happened. It took that long for the word of what had happened to reach back to New York. Beyond that, there was some coverage of what you're talking about. Perhaps not as much as there would be, certainly not as much as there would be now when we would send people there and would know about it much quicker.
Mm-hmm. Thanks,
Eugene, for your call. We go to Paul next from Shatek. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Just a quick comment on the text of the Gettysburg Address. I was researching that a little while ago and heard that there were two or three copies that the historians pondered over. And that Lincoln was still rewriting it after he gave the speech. The possibility is that the text you have is the true, authentic one, although we may never know.
Oh.
Yes, I read that, too, in doing some of this work. And what you said right there at the end is the problem. We'll never know.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call.
Yes, thank you very much.
Are there periods of history, as you look at all of this, that, I mean, this is a paper of record, certainly, so you're usually up to the task, but are there times when there were major stories, be it from war or the economy or whatever, that you didn't pay enough attention to or didn't see that it was going to evolve into a huge story?
I think looking back, the Holocaust falls into the first category there of something that we did not play up as much as we might have. I don't know what it would have been like to have been a correspondent in Europe covering during World War II, been a reporter there. I don't know what people knew about what was going on. But given what we know now about the Holocaust, it's hard to imagine that somehow, if you talk to enough people, you wouldn't have had some sense of what was going on. So I guess in my mind, that stands out.
And must make you, if you think about it long enough, you could stay awake at night because of it, because the newspaper could have perhaps moved things more quickly?
I don't know.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls, 800-486-8655. We have lines open for you right now, and our guest is James Barron, reporter on the Metropolitan staff of the New York Times. He wrote the minute-by-minute stories of the 9/11 attacks for the New York Times. We'll talk to him about that, and also the front-page lead story. He had his story fronted on 2003 blackout. He writes a podcast for the Times website summarizing the next morning's front page and is a contributor to the book that we're talking about, the New York Times, the complete front pages, 1851 to 2008. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. James Barron, our guest, and we're talking this hour about the just-published, the complete front pages, 1851 to 2008 of the New York Times. I'd like to talk to you in some detail about writing these minute-by-minute stories of the attacks, the 9/11 attacks for the New York Times. What a job that must have been, James.
Yes, this was for the Times on the web, and so even though this was, it seems so recent, it was 7 years ago in the life of the web and in the life of what we provide to the web. I guess it was the first time we'd ever tackled a story on that scale and put it on the web almost in real time.
Mm.
It was an unthinkable day, unimaginable. I mean, the idea that both of those buildings could be gone in less than 2 hours. I mean, two of my colleagues wrote a book called 102 Minutes, I think, named for the length of time between when the first plane hit and when the towers collapsed. They took so long to build those buildings. They were such a fixture on the landscape here in New York for so long, and in less than 2 hours, they were gone.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there was trying to make sense of how many people were in them, whether it was a larger attack, even at first, was it a coordinated attack in the sense of was it the four planes? When the first one hit, nobody really knew, you
mm-hmm.
know, and the initial reports on that, some of them were it was a small plane, not a big jetliner still loaded with enough fuel to start a serious fire, loaded, you know, for a cross-country flight. And so some of it was just sorting out, as it always is in a story, I guess, what it all means, getting the facts
sure.
and then trying to figure out, well, what does that really mean?
Right.
And, of course, look what that opened the door to. It opened the door to the war on terror and even in a way to the story yesterday about Al-Zahiri and what he had to say about President-elect Obama.
Mm-hmm. There were so many parts, and you're right, they continue to be so many parts, but what a thing to have to deal with as a reporter, because you've got the enormous human tragedy, and it's happening right in front of your eyes.
Yes.
And then the foreign aspect of all of this is, as you say, learning about this world that not very many people knew much about, right?
Yes, I think that's true, although we had run a long series earlier that year that laid out many of the things that, for lack of a better way to put it, you needed to know. In other words, identifying the personalities in Al-Qaeda and many of the people that we've become quite familiar with since then were in this long series that ran several parts, I think, at the beginning of that year or else in 2000. One of the great things about the New York Times is It does do pieces like that, series like that, that are ahead of the immediate news. And so the seeds of all of that were there, and people on our staff saw them and did those pieces, which I remember going back and rereading, and I remembered when they'd been in the paper the first time, but it didn't have the urgency, I guess, when they were first in the paper, for me at least, as a reader. But then again, I would never have imagined hijacking planes. I mean, I thought that went out in the 70s, or flying them into buildings like the World Trade Center here. Perhaps if I had been, I don't really want to say it, but perhaps if I'd been sitting around and trying to think like a terrorist, I might have thought, well, you know, could you get into the airspace around the buildings in Washington? Well, we learned that day it turned out to be much easier than I would have thought.
Right. Where were you that morning, James, and how did you go from, obviously, an observer of the horror of what was happening to reporting on it?
Most of the time, I'm not a morning person, this part of the morning is not a problem, but, we get up around 8 in our house and, kind of slow, and this was a morning paper, and so you could get to work about 10:30 or 11. One of our friends, a woman who was in our wedding party, called at about 9:05 and said, you're going to want to turn on the TV, because she knows we also don't usually turn on the TV when we're sitting there drinking coffee and eating breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
I went and turned on the television, and it was a Tuesday morning, I guess. The TV was still on the Fox station from here in New York, because at the time my wife was very much into the Ally McBeal show, and that had been on the night before, and then we turned it off. So I heard the local Fox anchor, even before the picture came in, I heard the audio of her saying something like, wait, you mean that was live? That wasn't taped.
Oh, my gosh.
And that's when I realized it was the second, there was a second plane. Nina on the phone, it must have said a plane has gone into the World Trade Center or something, but it was get the TV on. And now the confusion of the anchor makes clear that they didn't have their traffic helicopter over there for the first one. This was a second one, because when the picture came in, I was seeing what the anchor was seeing, which was now, I guess, two fires or a second plume of smoke building. I dressed as quickly as I could and went on down to the paper, and the day went on from there.
And you were getting, how do you do minute-by-minute reports? Were you getting calls from people?
Yeah,
you
talked to all of the people we had sent out. In effect, I was sort of the last guy on the relay team that they were handing the baton to, each of them. And so it was a combination of talking to the people we had sent there and other places, talking to people in Washington. In some cases, partly just to speed it up partly to make it go easier, watching the press conferences that our people were at when they would turn up on television. I mean, in a situation like this where you can see on television, or in some cases, I guess now on the web, the live coverage of what your own people are there for, if you're doing what I was assigned to do that week, you can extrapolate a lot of it just from watching from here like that. And then you can find out what the officials may have said that you didn't see that the reporters who are in the room can tell you.
Right.
So that at some point then when you go to construct a story, it becomes very much like building a house. You know what happened and you can put up the framework. I mean, as I say, by the time we were ready to go with it, with our version of it, sometime in the, I guess, late morning for the web, we knew about the others, so you could open with a sentence that began something like, in a carefully coordinated series of attacks, and go from there. Well, mm-hmm. it's sort of like you've built the foundation of it, and then each thing that happens, mm-hmm. as someone said something during the day, you could add details to it. You could put up another version that picked up what we learned as the day went on.
Interesting. What a day. What a day.
Yeah, I know.
Peter is a next caller from Stoughton. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Hello.
One thing I've always enjoyed about reading materials like New York Times and or, for instance, the New Yorker magazine is what's going on besides the headlines, what's going on in the background. I have kind of a small complaint here. I've been reading the New Yorker the New York Times for years online, and of course you try and see the front page of something that happened quite a few years ago, and you can never read the details just because of the resolution and such, or it's edited out. Now I've got to go and buy another piece of furniture to support another nice big volume that I'm never going to get through. I'm already dealing with the New Yorker magazine covers and the
right.
cartoons,
too.
And I'm nagging my family to get me the computer condensed
yes.
New Yorker magazine.
Yes, I know that one.
I just have to figure out what 20 years of my life I'm going to put aside to read all of that, plus the New York Times now. So I guess I thank you for doing this, but at the same time, I'll get around to it one of these days.
You know, thank you for that, and I'm going to take that in a positive spirit. You know, if you I suppose it could be worse. I mean, if you think about what the technology of the DVD-ROMs has allowed us to do, which is hand you three DVD-ROMs. They're pretty much palm-sized. So you can hold everything that the New York Times published on the front page from opening day in 1851 until some point in April or May of this year. We had to cut it off at some point this year to have the book in your hand by now. So that's three DVD-ROMs, small, portable. If you stacked all of those papers, those 54,000 and some papers, into a single pile, that stack would be 300 feet or so taller than the Empire State.
Oh, my gosh.
And, you know, if you didn't stack them that high, but you tried to stack them like in your house, I'd probably get thrown out of my, I'd need a much bigger house.
Right.
From the standpoint of convenience, I hope you agree this is wonderful. I know what you mean about there's never enough time. When I got married, my wife said I had to work on stretching out time so we would have more time together. So far, I haven't figured out how to do that.
Thank you so much, Peter, for your call. We have some lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well. That's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. John Treader, our producer, was wondering about how the Times covered the Great Depression. And if indeed there are a lot of people who are planning policy today and who are learning from the past, which we all have to lest we repeat it, to figure out what's applicable for today. First of all, how did you cover the Depression?
I think we knew when the crashes were happening, but I had the feeling reading those stories that we didn't initially see it was going to be as bad from Black Friday and I guess Black Tuesday as it turned out to be. Part of the thing that I remember from doing these summaries was having to go back and make sure that we were pulling the right front pages for the days everybody has come to identify, because every one of them looked so bad. I mean, it was sort of like after a week of down markets, it's like we almost didn't know how to play the next one. You know, it in that way, reading it, this was 7 or 8 months ago now, but there have been times here lately where I've felt myself the same way. I'm not speaking there about how we've played the stories. I'm just talking about my own reaction when I'd hear about, you know, the market is down and you know, this has happened. When the Lehman Brothers going out of business, I had the sense of this is another one of those moments, and it took me back to going through the front pages from 1929 that, you know, that was a defining moment, and yet it may come to recede in importance in our minds as time goes on. You can't see yet, you know, it's sort of like being in a tunnel, I guess. We're in the tunnel, and until you're out of the tunnel, until the period you're in has sort of ended, you can't really look back and do what a historian is going to do, which is get the contours of it right and the context of it really right.
Right.
But I think the Times has been doing a good job at this time around at doing it, and I think in the end, what you realize is about 1929 is they were all scary. Every one of those front pages reflected the fear that was going in, that was in people's minds.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to phone calls, 800-486-8655, and we will go to Phil from Mount Horeb. I'm sorry, we got the wrong line for that. Let's go to Phil from Mount Horeb. Hi, Phil.
Hi. In the movie 3 Days of the Condor with Robert Redford and Dale Robertson, you may have seen that movie.
Yes, a long time ago.
Yeah. Dale Robertson, who is a member of the inner intelligence of the CIA, of the U.S. government, confronts Robert Redford, who has just told Dale Robertson that he has submitted a story to the New York Times about the covert operation and the assassination of a whole group of people that Robert Redford had worked with but had escaped. And I'm wondering if Dale Robertson's question, how do you know, applies here. And how do you know refers to the assertion by Robert Redford that the New York Times would print the story. Can you recall back to that particular movie and let me know, because I've always been wondering, would the New York Times have printed that story?
I've always assumed that it was fictional in the sense of the plot that was being described there. I thought, for the sake of making a movie, that when you say, how do you know, meaning, and here I'm going by your recollection, I'll tell you in a minute mainly what I'm remembering, how do you know they're going to print it, and you look at Robert Redford, how can you not look at Robert Redford and believe that anybody's going to do the right thing? If the right thing is print the story, expose what had been going on, then of course it's going to happen. I mean, in the sense of that's why you have somebody like Robert Redford playing a role like that. It's why, you know, I mean, I don't want to overdo this, but it's sort of like, you know, it's one of those you got to believe moments. And just as you got to believe Robert Redford is going to do the right thing, then you got to believe the other great institutions in America are going to do the right thing. And you know,
for me, the movie is timeless because it's an eternal question regarding our media, which I see as the safeguarder of the democracy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and that
mm-hmm.
is that the media is going to do the right thing and is going to expose government when it's gone awry and preserve the democracy in that process.
No, I mean, and I think we're very, aware of that larger point. Part of what I was struggling with a moment ago is I don't remember the movie as well as I should. It's been a long time, and you now know what I'm going to rent or borrow
and watch
the weekend. My enduring image of it is a visual one that it took place in front of our old building. We moved out of there, I guess, two summers ago. It's two blocks from where I am now in the new building. And so it was always this sort of enduring visual image of 43rd Street in the mid-70s. And the fact that, of course, that's where the New York Times is, and of course, you know, in terms of everything that you said, and more articulately than I, that you know, if it needs to look into what the government is doing and find something that's wrong, they're going to print it, just as they did with the Pentagon Papers. I mean, if you look at the significance of the Pentagon Papers here, the government threatened basically to put the paper out of business. And the courts upheld our right to go ahead and print the Pentagon Papers.
Thank you so much for the call,
yeah,
Phil.
Yeah, thank you. That was a good one. And now, as I say, now you know what movie I'm going to watch over the weekend.
I think many of us will do the same. Let's go to Phil from Golden Lake. Hello, Phil.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Thanks. Thanks for taking my call. Pretty neat project. My sister and I have been researching some family history, and she was browsing for one of our distant relatives on the web and came up with a New York Times article from 1885, the headline, The Bold Way in Which a Milwaukee Millionaire Was Robbed.
And how did they do it?
It going to one point in the middle of the night, but at any rate... it doesn't say what page in the New York Times this is from. I would doubt it was on the page, but it could have been a slow news day. You never know. The money didn't come down to our side of the family, by the way. But at any rate, I'm just wondering. I mean, was this pretty common to have news from around the country of that sort of nature in the Times at that time? And is there some site we can go on to and find out if? I was thinking this might be a nice Christmas present.
No.
Find out what date it appeared?
Well, it's got the date here, but it doesn't say what page of the paper.
Oh, I think that's findable. My sense is dispatches from around the country and around the world were very much like that in the 19th century. If there was someone, a correspondent who... heard of something in Milwaukee, he could send it in by cable and the paper would print it. Part of what the paper was trying to do in those days, I think, was very much like what television was trying to do in the 50s. I don't know if you're old enough to remember. I'm not really, but for a story once, I got hold of the opening day of the Today Show. And they had it all set up to show what television could do to connect the country. And so they had, the show originated from New York, but at some point they were able to go to Washington and show cars driving by. They didn't have anybody set up to interview there, and there was really nothing going on. It was just another day in the life of the United States. But for television, it was being able to show they could reach to those places. Well, if you go back to the sort of go back two steps, I guess, in terms of technology of how information reaches you, before television, there was radio, so you could hear a person who was actually in Milwaukee or in Los Angeles when they or someplace far away. That person's voice could come right into your living room. And before that existed, there were newspapers to tell you what someone in Milwaukee had sent in to the newspaper office, either by cable or I suppose by mail, and so there was a lot of that in the paper of reports of far flung places. It was a way for newspapers, at least in urban centers like New York, to say what else is going on out in the world. And similarly, people there, of course, wanted to know what was going on in New York, what the fashions were, what the, what the latest in crime even was. You know, the burglars probably would be reading the paper to see what they could adapt back home. And so I think there was quite a sense of tying the nation together in that way.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for the call.
Yeah.
How about this one that came from, he was talking about Wisconsin, and this happened just about a block from where I am right now. Maniac in Milwaukee shoots Colonel Roosevelt. He ignores wounds, speaks an hour, and goes to the hospital.
Oh, yes.
We'll always remember that story here.
That was in the, yes, that's in the book now. And, uh-huh. and as I recall, he really didn't get treated until, what, the following day? I'm not able to look at this right now, but I think he... And the people there in Milwaukee are going to call me out for my memory being faulty here, but I think he went on. Maybe he didn't actually get treated until a day later. It was just one of those amazing
right.
things, and it's sort of like if they had known, if they'd been paying in as much attention, perhaps as we hope the Secret Service does now, that they would have known that this that the gunman had had a thing, had it out for him.
Yeah. Now there's a word you probably don't use very much anymore, right? Maniac. People don't use that word much anymore. Maniac.
Well, not in. I suppose tabloids might.
Right.
Tabloid newspapers might. For one thing, if you're a headline writer. It's nice and short.
Right.
It'll fit in a, if you're writing a headline in very large type, that's a great word because it doesn't take up much space.
Mm-hmm.
But it has a judgmental quality on your part using it. It implies a lot of things that I'm not sure you would know in the wake of a shooting, in the chaos immediately after a shooting.
Hmm. More phone calls in a moment, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the complete front pages, 1851 to 2008, the New York Times. And we're taking emails, too, but we don't – well, we would, but we don't have any. So that's talk@WPR.org. James Barron is our guest. He wrote all the timeline summaries for the book, and he's on the Metro staff of the New York Times and does a lot of – web work. He does a podcast for the Times website summarizing the next morning's front page. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to your phone calls. Ed from West Allis is next. Hi, Ed.
Well, Kathleen, it's actually four blocks from where you are right now. And PR was treated 2.5 hours after the shooting at the County Emergency Hospital on 24th in Wisconsin. And he didn't have Secret Service protection because he wasn't president then.
That's right.
The thing I want to talk about is the Times treatment of the Kennedy assassination since we're at the 45th anniversary of that day. Mm-hmm. And I just want to know what the Times did differently, how they handled it, and what they think they added to that sad date.
I think that was another day night like 9/11 when everybody worked. Everybody came in and you just knew you probably wouldn't get to deal with a story like that again. Tom Wicker was the White House correspondent at the time. He was traveling with the president, I believe, in a bus somewhere behind the limousine. So he very quickly became aware of what was going on. And I assume that the bus followed the limousine on past the school book depository and on out to the hospital. And from there, it was the usual process that you go through of no matter how big the story, of trying to figure out what had happened, maybe even in the beginning from things I've read, why are we going here instead of over there in that case, just in the immediate moments after, and then the reality settling in and just trying to write the best, most complete story that you can.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Ed. Let's go to Rose next from Chatville, Minnesota. Hi, Rose.
Hark, top of the morning to the Irish lass. As a former resident of the Twin Cities, I worked at all the computer companies there, reading at least 10,000 pages of scientific programming language. And in the 80s, this little company, well, it was a large company, but we manufactured tabletop computers for the Iranians. The keyboards were in Farsi, and the Shah and his family came through. And then, you know, after I lived there, then I came back to my hometown. And so for the last 7 or maybe 10 years, I have not had a computer or a television.
Oh,
and
my.
On that morning of 9/11, Gene Faraca was interviewing someone from Manhattan. And I remember listening, and the guy said, you know, I'm looking out the window, and I see this ball of fire in the air. And so then I'm calling all my friends that work at the Mayo Clinic and all these people that I knew and telling them about this incident.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a very low-tech person, but I want my daughters to read that CD and see some of the history in our country. I mean, I think, you know, for the I think we should have a new book. A black history book written by blacks, and everybody in our country should read it. But it's great, and thank you for putting me on air.
Thanks, Rose.
You're
Thanks
welcome.
Thanks very
Bye-bye.
Much for the call. Was there a time in history that you immediately went to when this book was assembled and wanted to read every front page, James?
I started with, I guess, the late 50s going into the 60s. And that was easy for me because that's when I was a child, and so things like the front page from when John Glenn orbited the Earth. I mean, it when you're a 7 or 8 year old child, you understood the enormity of that because in second grade class we had sort of play acted what it would be like to be on a spaceship. But I suppose my other enduring memory as an 8 year old of John Glenn orbiting the Earth was it was the same week I was on Bozo the Clown. The
no.
TV show. And the good thing about it was if I'm remembering it right, John Glenn orbited the Earth on a Tuesday. Well, luckily I was on Bozo the Clown on Monday because the show was preempted the rest of the week. On Tuesday they had to get John Glenn out of the water, or they had a press conference about that, and I think the following day President Kennedy had a press conference. So that if I hadn't gotten in on Monday, I wouldn't have been on at all. So when you're an 8 year old, even that way you have a connection to the news. I mean, it's sort of like the where were you when kind of question that we all have.
Right. Darn, if I had known you were on Bozo the Clown, I would have included it in your intro, James. I'm so sorry.
Well, Kathleen, look, if you want to go a step farther, this book apparently weighs 8 pounds, 3 ounces. I only weighed in at 7 pounds, 12 ounces, and no, I'm not going to tell you what I've ballooned up to now as a middle-aged guy.
Let's go to Bonnie next from Madison. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Well, I you know, do admire the New York Times, but during the 80s, I was very exasperated with their coverage of Central America, and I remember a big headline saying that Soviet MiGs were being sent to Sandinista, Nicaragua, a huge headline, and it was completely untrue. It had been something that had been leaked by the neocons in the State Department, some of the same people that were involved in the Nicaragua policy. And when the retraction came, it was like buried way in the back. So the public was still left the impression that, you know, Nicaragua was acquiring MiGs to attack neighboring countries. And on the whole, over the years, I do believe the New York Times has been quite hostile to leftist movements in Latin America, as someone who's been quite interested in that, and many of my friends are.
All right, let's get an answer. We have about a minute, James.
Well, I'm sorry that you think that, and I'm not as familiar with the details on it as you are. In fact, this makes me think that besides watching 3 Days of the Condor, I'm going to have to go and look back at some of those front pages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks so much for the call. Well, it was quite a feat to put all of this together. I'm glad you did, but it does weigh a lot, doesn't it? It really does.
It's a heavyweight book.
It's a very heavyweight book from a very heavyweight organization. James, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for letting me be on.
Yeah, it was fun.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it was. It was fun. James Barron, our guest, he helped put together this very large and important book for historical reasons, isn't it? He wrote all the timeline summaries of the book so that you start in 1851 and you go to 2008, and each decade has a summary of things that went on during that decade, which is a nice way to organize the book. So it's just filled with all the front pages, 300 or something of front pages in print. And then there are three DVD-ROMs with all of the 54,267 front pages and links to the full articles. It'll take a lot of time well spent. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and for all of your calls and interest in all of our subjects. Thanks so much. I'll be with you again on Monday. Monday at 9 is our All Things Political Hour, so we'll look at what cabinet positions may be floated about the next few days, talk about that, and all things political Monday at 9. It's a minute before 11. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.